iLearn scores show a slight improvement. Biden administration action on abortion. Plus, Todd Rokita threatens a doctor who performs abortions and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending July 15th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana standardized test data shows that most elementary and middle schoolers are learning as much academically as they did before the pandemic, but many students are still struggling. From WFYI's education desk, Dylan Pierce McCoy reports that the lowest performing students are losing ground.
Indiana students missed out on a lot of instruction because of the pandemic. Now it's a sprint to help them catch up academically. But a new state study of iLearn results shows that the lowest performing students actually made less progress this school year than before the pandemic.
As a state, these kind of results should be a big flashing red light. We have to do something because there's nothing that I think is more important.
Scott Bess is a member of the Indiana State Board of Education. He says the state should consider increasing funding so schools can help students learn faster. Education leaders say strategies such as tutoring, extra staff, and summer school could help.
Are the latest iLearn results a sign of optimism or concern? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief for the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, how should Hoosiers feel? We talked a lot about education and recovery from the pandemic. How should they feel about these latest numbers?
Well, we also spent a lot of time investing in it and focusing on it. The legislature spent a lot of time last session, the session before, identifying dollars exactly for this purpose. So I think you feel good about it. I think if you rewind 2 years, one of the dynamics in remote learning, e-learning, was that it wasn't equal across economic classes, certainly across school districts. So I think what these numbers reflect is what I think the concern was at the time, that kids in lower income, lower performing schools just don't have the resources to transition. One day you're going to school on the bus every day, and the next you're sitting at the kitchen counter. And that's exacerbated by parents, you know, the parents of those kids that couldn't remote work. You know, it was very much during COVID like a problem of affluence. If you could work from home, if you had a school district like my kids did, that already had a robust e-learning platform that the kids already knew. It wasn't like it was seamless. They just went to e-learning the next day. So the legislature generally invested in this. It looks now like they need to specifically invest in that population.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. We talked a little bit on the show in the last few months about how maybe more investment is needed in learning loss. Is this essentially good news in that we've now found a way perhaps we can better target that?
Well, we've got to put the money in. We've got to have the after-school programs and the tutoring programs and all to catch these children up, because it's, you know, you can ask any realtor. They can tell you by zip code how the schools are going to be and how the kids are going to do, by and large. And that's true here. In a lot of these districts, we've allowed the charter schools and the vouchers and all of this without adequate supervision. And a lot of the money that should be going into these kids in public education, the 93% of them in regular public education, is being diverted. And we need to re-examine that and make certain that we put the resources behind catching those children up. This has been the problem all along. I mean, granted, the pandemic has exacerbated it and brought it to our attention, but these are the same schools that have been falling behind forever. And we talk about doing something about it and have forever, and we haven't done it. And it's time. We have the money.
It feels like there's been building discussion at the State House over complexity, which is the idea in the school funding formula that, well, you have a set amount that goes to every kid in every school no matter what, but then you build in this complexity index that is supposed to give more dollars to generally lower income students. And Republican lawmakers have been shrinking that, and there's talk of shrinking it even further. Does this stop some of that talk, or does it go on regardless?
Yeah, I mean, the last couple of years, it's been about treating all the kids the same, but not all the kids are the same. And so I think what they've done recently on complexity is sort of cap it, things like that. But I hope they look closely at these scores, because while there was improvement, you know, those, the ones, if you're already behind, and those are the kids who would get those complexity dollars, they're the ones who need it even more, and they need sustained sort of targeted, right, you know, dollars like that. So, but we don't do a school, well, we'll do one in January, but so in the meantime, though, there's probably another year before that would kick in. So I hope they find something in the meantime to sort of help those kids.
And target it.
Yeah,
and target it.
Yeah. So, John, to return sort of to my first question at the top, which was, are these scores a sign of optimism or concern? It's probably both, right? Because for a lot of kids, at least we seem to have gotten back to where we were, which is better than,
well,
maybe I think
we
some
were
people
better,
wondered.
We were better than the year, I mean, than the immediate past, but we have still shown an inability as a state to recover to the point where we were. And let's keep in mind, this is a relatively new test. It's not like we can do apples to apples.
That's
with
true.
A lot of sort of things. But it appears that we are not back even to where we were before. And even if we were, should we celebrate the fact that 30% of kids can pass both the math and the English portions of this and say, well, but we're doing better? And I understand that progress is something to cherish. But I bet right now if I went out and ran a mile, I could maybe do 15-minute mile. If I train, I could probably cut that to 14. But that's not reason to celebrate. That still shows you how pathetically slow I am. And I'm not competitive in any arena running. Thankfully, that's not the arena in which I compete. But so we can't really celebrate, I don't think, as a state, 30% passage rate.
No.
Let's keep that in mind.
Yeah.
But the kids who are, you know, that 30% is the universe. If you look at kids on the free lunch program, then it comes down to 17% passing both, 42% on the wealthier districts, and that's why you get that.
Right.
So really, it's the disadvantaged getting more disadvantaged, and I guess that's
and
not
we're
a
getting
surprise.
Fewer students going on to higher education too,
right,
which is another one of the supposed goals of the Republican Party, and we're not meeting that either.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, are the latest iLearn test scores a sign of optimism or concern? You can choose optimism, concern, both, as I just posited, or neither. Last week's question was, will $225 in Governor Holcomb's inflation relief proposal make a difference to Hoosiers who are struggling with high inflation? Just 19% of you say yes, 81% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The Biden administration this week told hospitals nationwide that they must provide abortion services if the life of the pregnant person is at risk. The Department of Health and Human Services says federal law on emergency treatment guidelines preempts state laws that now ban abortion without any exceptions following the Supreme Court's decision ending guaranteed abortion rights. HHS cited requirements on medical facilities in the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. The law requires medical facilities to determine whether a person seeking treatment may be in labor or whether they face an emergency health situation or one that could develop into an emergency, and to provide treatment, including if that requires an abortion.
Andalani, Texas has already sued the Biden administration over this directive. I'm guessing it won't be the only state to do so. Will this hold up?
I actually think it will, because this isn't a directive from Joe Biden. This is part of a law that says if you're receiving federal dollars at a hospital, you've got to provide these services. And as we've seen in a number of cases before, now, of course, this is the Supreme Court of Donald Trump, and I suppose anything can happen, and precedent doesn't matter at all. But generally speaking, when it's federal money involved, the federal government can call the shots, as they do in Title IX and speeds on highways and all these other criteria that they've established over the years. If you put federal dollars in it, you know, but that's not going to stop, like, the governor of Texas and probably the attorney general of Indiana and all of those politicians who all they want to do is get headlines that'll fire up their base. That's all they care about. They don't care about whether they have a leg to stand on or anything else. So there'll be more suits like this, but I think this one will be different in that it's federal dollars. Those hospitals are free to say no, you know, if they don't want to provide that service.
Mike, so, I'm not going to pretend you're tapped into the progressive wing of the Democratic Party or
just
anything.
The Republican one.
Yeah.
you're it,
one person.
But
But a lot of people have been very, in that progressive wing, have been very frustrated with what they perceive as a lack of action from the Biden administration in the wake of Roe being overturned. Is this going to be enough to satisfy folks?
No, not at all. And I mean, there is now a tension and criticism from Democrats, progressive Democrats, on why Congress didn't. Now Joe Biden's going to come in and say, well, we're going to short circuit the Senate rules so we can ban abortion. The progressive wing of the party is going, why didn't we do that when we had huge majorities? Why weren't we doing that 10 or 15 years ago?
Because they thought that they could rely on the Supreme Court nominees telling the truth.
That was a mistake.
Yeah.
So they all lie, is what you're saying.
No, on this, I mean, look, when the largest purchaser of health care in the country says this is how you're going to do it, that's how you're going to do it.
Yeah.
But if I'm a general counsel at a hospital, in a hospital system, I'm looking to the state. Now I've got to think about, what's the head of CMS telling me? What's my local prosecutor doing? What's the state legislature saying?
That's true everywhere.
So these guys need, what they need is, regardless of your position, they need clarity on what they're permitted to do and however this shakes out.
John, that was something I wanted to ask you, which is, this directive makes a lot of sense in that it seems relatively limited. It's not trying to blow up this existing law to realms it never. It says you have to provide emergency medical care. Abortion care is medical care. If that's what it takes to save a life, that's what you have to do. It's very straightforward. I don't know if it'll hold up in court, but it seems very straightforward. But to the point Mike just made, if you're the doctor in the room, you are terrified about being prosecuted, even if you end up getting off because of what the federal government says, is this really going to save the lives it's intended to save?
I don't know. It's hard to feel. A lot of people don't feel much sympathy for hospital administrators because they say, they say, gee, I go in there for my broken finger and I come out with a $20,000 bill. But as you both have suggested, this is a reason to feel sorry for hospital administrators and physicians especially, because they're the ones who will really be targeted. But it does beg the question, in these states such as Texas, will we see, Texas law enforcement? I know now we have guards now to protect people, in the hospital from gang violence and so forth. In many places there are screenings. But now, did we have law enforcement in the ER, the operating room, to basically see if the person who's going in for a quote-unquote emergency meets the whatever
statutory
definition? Because that seems to me to be, when you talk about the health of a mother or one person's emergency is not somebody else's. I'm sure there are statutory guidelines, or at least rules have been promulgated over the past.
There's a layperson standard.
Right. But the rules don't apply anymore, I don't think, for the reasons that what we all thought was, let's call it, settled law and settled rulemaking.
If you rely on
is
some
in
kind
a
of
state
like,
of flux.
Let's try to rely on some conservative principle in this. Like, stay with me.
Right. Well,
this is the market is going to have to decide economically what the trade-off is here, because the federal government purchases more health care than anybody in the country, insurance companies or anything.
Some questions are going to be easy.
Hospitals have to make that decision.
Some questions are going to be easy. I think like 1 in 10 pregnancies is ectopic.
Right.
And the woman dies and the fetus dies if something isn't
done.
Yeah,
these aren't necessarily
those
emergencies.
Are easy. Well, and
where you present the emergency.
You've got to also remember the Biden administration is saying that they can't interfere with the postal ability to send the pills in, which is why how that 10-year-old had the, if you're in the first early pregnancy, you can do it by postal service. You don't need to have a hospital. So there are things that they're not going to be able to control.
The other administrative complexity may just be those healthcare providers, and we've seen this come up around the country from time to time, where they don't feel they have conscientious objections to performing these, and now they're going to be emboldened and empowered and say, well, the Supreme Court's on my side. So if you
don't have, if you're thinly staffed
anyway, and you all of a sudden are a hospital in a rural area and you have this life and death emergency, but you also have a staff that says, I'm not going to do it, then that's why I start. That's
so
why
then
I'm feeling
have
sorry.
Dead people on their hands and they'll have lawsuits.
I just wondered how much of a threat this really is, because you're talking about, the Biden administration can take, we're talking about Medicare funding away from a hospital and Medicaid. But that means tens and hundreds of thousands of people don't get care. I'm not sure that that's a threat that they're going to be
able to follow through on.
Will they really yank this funding?
Yeah, they only have to do it once.
It's a big gamble because other people will die.
People are going to die as a result of the Supreme Court's decision, period. They're going to, okay? And they don't care.
Speaking of abortion.
Yeah.
And Indiana, I feel like I'm going to be saying that a lot on the show for the next few weeks. An Indiana doctor is considering legal action against Attorney General Todd Rokita after he went on national television to make baseless accusations against her.
In the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning abortion rights, an Indianapolis Star story went viral that a 10-year-old girl had to travel from Ohio to Indiana to get an abortion after being allegedly raped. Conservatives jumped on the story, decrying it as false, until police arrested a man Wednesday for the crime. Todd Rokita then went on Fox News to make baseless accusations about the doctor that performed the abortion.
We're gathering the information, we're gathering the evidence as we speak, and we're going to fight this to the end, including looking at her licensure.
But less than a day after Rokita made those threats, multiple media outlets reported that the doctor had properly filed her report with the state, on top of which she has no discipline on her medical license. Yet Rokita told the Indy Star he plans to continue with his investigation.
Nikki Kelly, I'm going to ask this question as a taxpayer here in Indiana. So I'm curious, what other perfectly legal activity is Todd Rokita going to waste my money investigating?
I mean, you know, he's a surprise, Brandon. He could come up with something. I honestly don't know where this is all heading. Clearly, you know, he saw an opportunity because this issue became a flashpoint, you know, this issue of the 10-year-old and having to come here and opportunity to get involved. I just think he got ahead of himself, you know, like actually doing the background, the work to see if any laws were broken before accusing someone of breaking laws. And so that was, I think, you know, maddening to a lot of people. And he would have been within his job to make sure. I mean, the Attorney General's office handles medical licensing. They file complaints against doctors who don't do their law. That's totally within his realm if he had just done it in a proper order and gotten some actual facts before spouting off on national television.
I mean, this is not the first time we've talked about Todd Rokita on this show in an area it feels like this. It feels like he just wants to get on TV. And that's the motivation behind a lot of what he does. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's sure what it feels like.
I think that's probably more statement than question. I mean,
What do you think about that statement?
I agree with your statement. So I guess in a statement, question becomes a statement to which I agree. Clearly that's the case, because if you wanted to simply follow the law wherever the law leads you, and if in fact this doctor had not lived up to the responsibility that comes with a medical license and state statute in terms of reporting these things, there would have been a mechanism for that. But that's not nearly as sexy. You don't get on the national news and lead the national news that way. So we've seen this over and over again. Now, the doctor in question has retained a very good attorney. I can't remember the name. What is the name again?
Very funny.
Ann's daughter. Draw your own conclusions. She's very good. Has a track record to show it. So, but the problem for her, I mean, yes, could Todd Rokita face maybe disciplinary action from the Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission as a member of the bar? Maybe. But in terms of any sort of liability for defamation, and I'm not an attorney, but my reading is there basically is blanket immunity based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision. I guess now always subject to change. But in the 70s, written by William Rehnquist, where a police department was putting out flyers of known shoplifters, and guess what? There was somebody in the flyer that wasn't a known shoplifter, but the Supreme Court said they're protected, even in a situation like that. So I don't think that's the avenue for regress or satisfaction much as perhaps this other.
It's always the question of whether he was acting in the scope of his duty, since he went on national television before he began his investigation. Because if he had done it the way Nikki suggests, there would not have been an investigation.
But as an elected official, he's held to a different standard than a rank-and-file state employee, I think.
Involved in this, because he lied. He lied.
You have
in
to
that
prove it, though.
It's not all that difficult. And the thing that gets me is that this shows why we talk about him. It just shows that there is no barrier for him. He will go as low as he can to get on television. He is a demagogue posing as a lawyer. And we elected him. I thought we had a really bad one the last time, who groped women and made them victims. Now we have somebody who's going to make women and children victims in order to get himself TV coverage.
I want to ask about stakes here, because in a vacuum, it's like, well, we've talked about this sort of thing with Todd Rokita. Some people find it very annoying and frustrating and all that. And that's fine. But in this case, we're talking about an issue in which, so this doctor used to practice in a South Bend clinic and had to stop for a while because she was getting death threats. She would not be the first abortion doctor in this country killed for performing abortions. This sort of stuff can get someone killed that Todd Rokita is just spouting off on TV about.
Well, look, I mean, the problem for me in this is like in talking to legislators as we're approaching this special session, there is a sense that they do want, the Senate's more going to be stricter on this than the House, I think, if I'm just predicting based on conversations, have a bill that has that does have exceptions. This Rokita approach is the Richard Murdoch approach politically. The politics of this aren't theoretical. We had a whole election on this exact point in abortion.
Yes, but a decade ago.
But a decade
and
ago,
things
which,
feel
which
like
should
they
make it worse, no. Right? But it hasn't. And the problem with, and I understand why Republican leaders have a lot of these conversations behind closed doors.
All of the conversations.
Trying to get ready and figure out exactly where everybody at and operate and what is the realm of the possible here and what is acceptable. Hang on, just give me a sec. And I understand why they're doing that. The problem, though, is in that vacuum, it's being filled right now with Todd Rokita, who's gaslighting a 10-year-old who got raped, and Jim Bopp, who is espousing this fantasy where this kid wakes up one day and goes, man, I'm glad that happened. Thank God the government forced me to have that kid. And that's the problem with trying to craft an abortion bill that makes sense for the vast majority of Hoosiers and Americans. This isn't a mystery where people are on this, now that we're in it. And it's getting extreme, and there's going to be a consequence for that.
All right. Pete Buttigieg is no longer a Hoosier. The U.S. Transportation Secretary and former South Bend mayor is officially moving to Michigan. Buttigieg and his husband Chasten bought a house in Traverse City, Michigan 2 years ago, the city where Chasten grew up. Now the former Hoosier presidential candidate says he plans to vote in the Wolverine state this fall. A spokesperson for Buttigieg told Politico, which first reported the story, that the couple wants to be closer to Chasten's parents, something increasingly important after they adopted twins last year. Many Indiana Democrats had often thrown out Buttigieg's name as a potential candidate for a variety of races, everything from governor to Senate to Congress. John Schwanes, realistically, is this a blow for the Indiana Democratic Party?
Sure, but more broadly, it's a blow for Indiana and for Hoosiers. It's kind of cool to be able to have people of prominence on the national political stage.
You can still recognize he used to be from Indiana.
I guess we can always say we do that with Abraham Lincoln. He spent his formative years. So we will do that, of course, with Pete Buttigieg. And I understand it. I applaud the fact that he wants to, with children now, be closer to the in-laws and grandparents who can be there to do that. All well and good. Hey, it's also 16 electoral votes versus right. 11 for Indiana.
And a swing state.
And that's, I'm sure, not factored in, but the cynics would not that
if
I'm
it was
one.
A Pennsylvania
would point that out. That if there only there were a grandmother, in Ohio or Florida. But you just hate to see that. And for the state party, it's also a sting because the chair of the state party now is from, that's where he hails from, South Bend, so you hate to see somebody who is a comrade in arms, yeah.
Does this highlight a problem for Democrats in that Buttigieg was a name that a lot of people threw around for maybe running for one of these big offices and cross him off the list?
Yeah, and I wrote about that today in a column. I mean, he's the young, sort of progressive, youthful guy, and people were looking forward to him running maybe for governor or for U.S. Senate, and now that's not going to be likelihood. And I think it's been since 2012 since the Democrats won a statewide election, and I think he was definitely the best hope, and now it's not there anymore.
All right. Well, finally, several sports books issued refunds recently over some wagers on the Nathan's Famous hot dog eating contest after a protester interfered with champion eater Joey Chestnut. Ann Delaney, if you're betting on the hot dog eating contest, should you look into problem gambling services? You're not putting any bets down on the hot dog eating contest, Emily?
No, and I think, problem gambling services and probably some kind of, medicine for your stomach after the fact. I don't get that. I just don't get that.
I am taking bets on whether I can run a 14-minute mile, as
I'll
I promised.
I'll take that bet.
We'll see if the Indiana Gaming Commission will allow that sort of bet. Yeah. Is this more a surprise that we allow bets on the hot dog eating contest than anything else?
Who does that?
There's literally no limit to things I'll bet on.
Certainly,
it's a competition with rules.
If someone runs out onto a football field and catches a football in the middle of a play, are they going to vacate those bets too?
Absolutely.
In some cases, I think
that could be a bet in and of itself.
Depending on how much you influence the outcome, theoretically you could.
Wow.
All right. We've learned a little today, I feel
I think you guys need a hobby.
Glad we could end on a
high note.
Sports betting. Besides sports betting.
That is the hobby. All right. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on from demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.